At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, sometimes the best stories are just one person talking. The Japanese earthquake from inside Fukushima on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday today, the 7th of March. Good to have you with us. And there will be business news on the broadcast today and economics and politics, too, after Super Tuesday yesterday. But we're going to start on the other side of the planet. A year ago, March 11th, 2011, in the Japanese earthquake and the tsunami, and one of the worst nuclear disasters ever. At the time, in the days right afterward, information coming out of the Fukushima Daiichi plant was spotty at best, hard to come by as well, which is part of what made that whole thing so scary. So for the rest of the week leading up to the anniversary, this coming Sunday, we're going to be airing a series of stories looking back at what happened and trying to figure out what, if anything, has been learned since then. The stories are being collected in a new public radio series called Burn, an energy journal. The first episode airs this weekend about nuclear power after Fukushima. And one of the things you're going to hear is that there were Americans inside the plant the day of that tsunami. Alex Chadwick talked to one of them.
Tomioka, Japan, a beach town of about 16,000 people and one nearby nuclear power plant, Fukushima Daiichi, with a half dozen reactors. For 40 American nuclear technicians, March 11th, 1 year ago, is supposed to be their last day on a two-month project. And it's a good day to finish. It's a Friday, clear, afternoon temperature in the 40s. Almost everyone is up at the office 15 minutes to the end of the shift. But Carl Pilateri is still working, and he's scheduled to stay on for a while.
I remember everyone else leaving. I remember thinking, how fortunate for me. And I'm allowed to stay another 3-4 weeks and put the stuff away, put it away right, you know.
Carl Pilateri is 53, a native of New Jersey, where he wasn't thinking of high tech. He barely graduated high school. But he's good with his hands, and he's very careful. And he travels most of the year now, tending to nuclear reactors, inspection and maintenance. And on this project, he's to oversee the complicated ritual of stowing away all their special tools. That's why he's staying on.
Another chance for me to shine, another chance for, you know, them to come back and take it out of storage, and everything's working great and oiled up nice.
He has two American and three Japanese techs with him. They call themselves Team Pilateri. The equipment is laid out on the vast floor space of the Reactor Number 1 turbine building. I'm no good at estimating size, Carl told us, but he guesses it's bigger than two football fields laid end to end. Everything is normal. Then, in the moment of 2:46 p.m. in Alaska's Aleutian Islands, an American Geoscience underwater microphone hears something originating 900 miles away off the coast of Japan. It's the beginning of the fourth largest earthquake in recorded history.
Did you feel it?
Yeah, sure. Of course. The very first shock of it. It was just one big hammer, and I turned to my two friends saying, earthquake, but they didn't feel it. They looked at me, kind of cocked their heads a little bit, and then she hit.
Reactor unit number 1 is online and fully operational. The turbine, the largest moving part, is a series of enormous steel blades on a very long horizontal axis. Imagine something like the mast of a small apartment building, but this is prone on its side. It spins in rotation 25 times a second, which it's doing now. In the entire nuclear plant complex, the turbine building is probably the worst place to be. Running at full speed, the turbine blades begin to shriek and moan.
They were almost demonic in the way they sounded. You know, it's just, and I don't know what was generating these sounds, if it was the earth itself or the building being flexed or moved or the upheaval of the building.
Parts of the building structure, not hard bolted in place, are crashing to the floor.
And there was one young Japanese boy in front of me, and this light came down like a guillotine right next to him.
Most of the fixtures are down. It's getting harder to see. Carl thinks he should help Team Pilateri get out, but the quake is still rolling. It's too dangerous to try to escape.
I had Danny over to the left screaming, "It's gonna blow, it's gonna blow, it's gonna blow."
He counts five men on the floor. The sixth is separated from the others in a crane above them. It hangs from double railings on the ceiling that run the length of the turbine.
This crane was just crabbing and jumping, and I'm thinking, please, please don't even attempt to get out of there.
How far up was he?
Oh, he had to be a good 30, 40 feet up in that cab, you know.
In a big earthquake, every second is frightening, and then every next second, more so, like a Richter scale of terror.
In one nanosecond, just the entire floor went black. Every light went out. And you would expect that some emergency lighting would come on, but there wasn't a one. I looked in the direction of where we normally come in, and there was this most welcome beam of white light coming out from the gap underneath the door. And I made my way over to the door, and I opened it up. But at the same time I opened that door, the one and only light that was in that room was swinging violently, busted free and shattered on the floor, and it was pitch black again. And I remember feeling, you and none of you are getting out of here. It was that's the message I got from it.
The enormous space is completely without light, filled instead by the wailing of the turbine and by silent prayers. The earthquake lasts for 6 minutes. The epicenter is about 100 miles away in the sea, but the effects on land are stunning. Carl does get everyone on Team Pilateri out of the turbine building. The ground still trembles and shakes from big aftershocks, and they know they should get to higher ground. This earthquake is sure to generate a large tsunami. About an hour later, separated from the others, Carl is on a small hillside still within the grounds of the Fukushima power plant. And he sees it. He sees it coming.
It resembled this huge swell of the ocean. It's as if someone had lifted everything and rolled it your way. Kind of like if you were to put water in a large cookie sheet or a pan or something like that, fill it with water. I just pick up one end and watch all that water slide to the other end. Billions of gallons were coming at us, and I wondered if I wasn't high enough.
It gets much closer than you would want, maybe 100 feet or so. It floods the power system to keep the reactors cool in an emergency. Within a day, the Fukushima reactor cores will be in meltdown.
I was wondering just how global is this thing. I remember thinking, good God, if there's an end of the world, is this it?
At last, the tsunami begins to recede. As it does, it pulls away the atmosphere with it. Dark clouds rush in from the western highlands. The air turns much colder. Carl Pilateri is alone on his hillside, a landscape of ruin before him. It begins to snow. By evening, Carl's work group retreats to the lobby of a nearby hotel. They stay the night there. The next day, they join a general evacuation to Tokyo, a little more than 100 miles south. It takes 14 hours, but they are all going home safely. Carl Pilateri continues as a nuclear technician today. He doesn't feel differently about nuclear power, he says, but he is haunted by Fukushima, by what happened, and by what he saw. This is Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex Chadwick is the host of the new public radio series, Burn, an energy journal. It's produced by Sound Vision Productions, funded by the National Science Foundation, and distributed by this company, APM. The first hour-long broadcast airs this weekend at nuclear power after Fukushima. There is a certain logistical beauty to the Greek debt crisis. Bondholders who own Greek debt have until tomorrow to agree to swap their devalued paper for slightly less devalued paper. Literally, swap it. But as is probably old news by now, actually making a Greek deadline might not be so easy, thus raising yet again the possibility of a default in Athens. Amazing as that might be. To get some clarity, we've got Stephen Beard on the line from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So in the plainest possible terms, what in the heck is going on with this Greek story now?
Right. Well, we've got two parallel deals here. All on right. The one hand, we had the European Union and the IMF agreeing to lend Greece $170 billion
yes.
to stave off default. Remember that one?
Yes.
That's dependent on Greece cutting its budget and reforming its economy, but it's also dependent on Greece's private sector creditors taking a hit. And this is what we're talking about here. This is the other deal under the spotlight at the moment. Banks and hedge funds holding Greek government bonds have been asked to take a write-off of about 75% of the value of their bonds. Right. And it seems quite a number of these private investors are digging in their heels and still saying no.
Why would they? I mean, 75% is a big loss to take, but it's that or nothing, right? Why would they be digging in their heels?
Well, they apparently believe they can screw a better deal out of the Greek government. There is, however, one theory that maybe these holdout bondholders have bought a load of the so-called credit default swaps. These are insurance policies that should pay out in full if Greece defaults. So maybe the thinking is these bondholders want Greece to default, so they'll make more money out of it.
All right, but wait a second. I thought this was sort of a voluntary swap, right?
Yes, I mean, it is voluntary if something like 90% of these bondholders agree.
Yeah.
If significantly fewer than that agree, but more than 75%, then the Greek government can force them to accept. That will not be voluntary, and that technically could be a default.
All right, fair enough. So once we're past the numbers game, what finally winds up happening? I mean, I hate to even ask you this because I've asked you so many times. Are we finally now done with Greece?
Well, not entirely. I mean, this still is on a knife edge, and there's a great deal at stake here. I mean, if this doesn't go through, the Greek government might not get that $170 billion bailout, and then it would default as early as March the 20th.
But, Stephen, here's the question that I'm going to get asked at the kids' soccer game this weekend, right? People know I work at Marketplace. They're going to say, well, what do you make of the Greece news? And I'm going to say, oh, it's bad. And they're going to say, but wait a minute. In the States, we're adding 216,000 jobs a month. Consumer confidence is up. The economy is growing. Yeah, gas is a little bit high, but you know, the apocalypse you guys have been talking about forever, where is it?
That's right. We got so used to this crisis.
Yeah.
It's kind of a familiar friend. There has been this growing sense, and particularly in some quarters in Germany, that maybe a Greek default wouldn't be such a disaster. But there's still a huge amount of uncertainty about this.
Yeah.
There still is a danger that this could still blow up and potentially plunge the global economy back into recession.
Always a joy, Stephen. Always a joy to chat. Stephen Beard in London, thank you.
Okay, Kai.
Personally, I was kind of hoping it would be the iPhone 5 being rolled out at the big Apple publicity event today. That would have been something, people. Instead, the iPad 3, better display, faster online, HD video, in stores next week. Sales guaranteed to be bananas, including, according to one online poll we saw, 42% of people who own an iPad now. That's how many people said they plan to buy the new one. So what do you suppose they're going to do with their old ones? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins got that assignment.
To get a sense of the market for used Apple products, I called up Gazelle, a reseller that buys used iPads, iPhones, and other electronics. I got executive Anthony Scarsella on the phone just as Apple was making its big announcement.
It's going to get crazy right about now. Right when they put this thing on the stage, our site is probably going to go haywire.
Scarsella says every time Apple announces a new product, owners of the old models descend on Gazelle.com.
Our best prices were about 2 weeks ago, right when rumors of the new iPad started.
Back then, Gazelle was offering about $300 for a used iPad. This morning, it was closer to $260. After Tim Cook took the stage, it dropped to $225. You can get more if you sell it yourself on eBay or Craigslist, but either way.
Now we're talking real money.
Michael Gartenberg is an analyst with Gartner.
Which is pretty significant because most consumer electronics, once it's purchased, usually have very little or low resale values.
The resale market for all sorts of consumer electronics is growing, approaching $1 billion this year. And that's because early adopters always want the new thing. And old things, especially Apple products, often hold their value. Paul Raines is the CEO of GameStop. The retailer started buying and reselling Apple products in September.
If you went to one of our stores, you'll see that our managers have waiting lists of people trying to buy an iPad 2.
But after today, they may not need to wait much longer. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Stephen Dubner.
And I'm here to tell you and your listeners that of all the areas in which the president's influence is overrated, the economy is probably number one.
Well, there you have it. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials regained 0.6% today, 78 points, closed at 12,837. The NASDAQ picked up 0.8%, 25 points on that index, 2,935. The S&P 500 added 0.2%, 9 points, finished at 1,352. Financial shares bounced back a bit from yesterday's rout. Morgan Stanley and Citigroup both up more than 3%. On the tech front, Pandora got pummeled after being downgraded by a couple of brokerages. Shares in the music service plunged nearly 24% today. Sirius XM Radio, on the other hand, dialed up 1.5%. And oh yeah, the new iPad thing that happened today, guess it was already priced in, as they say. Apple shares gained less than 0.1%. On the retail front, Stage stores packed a 10% gain on. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.98%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Obama meets with the President of Ghana at the White House. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee discusses education and America's global competitiveness. And it depicted some stuff one shouldn't try at home. The series Beavis and Butthead premiered on MTV on March 8, 1993. Heh. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're in college or if you have a child in college for whom you want only the best, you're not going to like what I'm about to say. The Economic Policy Institute, this think tank in Washington, released a study today showing wages for college graduates have fallen over the past decade, more than 10% for some. Be that as it may, commentator Robert Reich says a college education is still the key to a brighter future.
Rick Santorum has called President Obama a snob for wanting everyone to get a college education. But Santorum needn't worry. America is already making it harder for young people of modest means to attend college. 41 states are cutting spending for public higher education this year, and tuition and fees are rising as a result. The children of middle and lower income families are hardest hit. Federal education grants are shrinking, and student debt is skyrocketing. Yet a four-year college degree now marks the great divide in America. Unemployment among college grads is just under 5%, but it's over 9% for those without college degrees. And the median pay of college grads is 70% higher than those with a high school diploma. Public higher education isn't just an investment in individuals, it's a public good. Our young people's capacities to think, investigate, and innovate are America's future. We understood this during the great expansion of public universities between the 1950s and 1970s, when tuition averaged about 4% of median family income. Today, public university tuition gobbles up 25%. Many qualified young people are discouraged from attending college at a time when America needs the brain power of its young people more than ever. So what's the answer? Public universities can surely be more efficient. But we should also charge higher tuitions for students from higher-income families. The extra money can be used to subsidize medium- and lower-income kids. Part of the answer also has to be more government support for public higher education. This requires more tax revenues, especially from Americans best able to pay. Call me old-fashioned, but I think America's richest citizens owe kids from middle- and lower-income families the chance to make it in America, especially when wealth and income are more concentrated at the top than they've been since the 1920s. We'll all gain from it, but if our young can no longer afford college, we all lose.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Let us know what you think. We're on Facebook. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you?
I've been worse.
You have? All right. Okay.
I'm doing all right.
You're doing all right. Great. You know why you're doing all right, though? Because Super Tuesday is behind you, man. You don't have to worry about politics anymore.
That is a big part of it. You know how I feel about the presidency.
That's where I was going, because generally you think it's overrated, right?
I do. I believe that the office of the President of the United States, that it just matters a lot less than most people think. Now, I will say, when I make this argument, I get hate mail from both sides of the aisle. So conservatives will accuse me of covering for President Obama, and liberals accuse me of kind of preempting criticism of some future Republican nominee.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, the man is the leader of the free world, so to speak. So what's the actual truth here, dude? How do you
feel? You know, look, personally, I have no horse in any race. I dislike both political parties about equally. But here's the thing. We're heading into a presidential campaign now that is likely to focus on the economy, and rightfully so.
Yep.
And I'm here to tell you and your listeners that of all the areas in which the president's influence is overrated, the economy is probably number one. So I'd like you here to listen to Austin Goolsbee, who's a former chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors.
I think the world vests too much power, certainly in the president, but probably in Washington in general, for its influence on the economy, because most all of the economy has nothing to do with the government.
I love the way he talks, by the way. Sounds like a mafia guy, doesn't he? All right, but wait, listen, you were around in the 92 election. You were paying attention, yes?
I was okay. A sentient being then,
that's
yes.
Right. So Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. That's why the guy won.
It's a fantastic campaign slogan. You get to brag about how you will raise employment and lower gas prices, as if, Kai, there's some magical set of buttons in the Oval Office that you get to push once you're elected, you know, more jobs button and so on. But as Austin Goolsbee points out, the president's ability to actually change the shape and the direction and the velocity of the macroeconomy, it's extremely limited.
Let me go back then to the actual politicians who say otherwise. You had Clinton, and now you've got Mitt Romney, former CEO, a business guy, goes out every stump speech he makes and he says, I know what to do in the economy. I've been there. I've created jobs. I've fired people, blah, blah, blah. You're not buying that?
I buy that he believes that to be true. A lot of people have believed that to be true in the past. This kind of common idea of the last 10, 15 years is president as CEO. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work that way. We set it up to not work that way. When it comes to unilateral decision making, there's no comparison between what a CEO can do and what a president can try to get done. Here's another way of looking at it, all with right. some actual data, okay, which is what we like to do.
I was waiting for the data, man. Come on.
In the 2004 Bush-Kerry presidential election, you may recall that there was a little bit of a snafu concerning the early exit polls.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Kerry was the winner for like, what, 3-something hours, 4 hours?
That's exactly right. It was announced that it was Kerry, but it turned out to be Bush. And the economist Justin Wolfers took advantage of that mix-up for a study that he did.
2004 was a social scientist dream. What you have is 4 hours. I'm a Democrat, so I'll say 4 beautiful hours. In which we basically had a Kerry presidency. And it was random.
So what Wolfers did is he looked at how the stock markets reacted to first the news of a Kerry presidency and then the new, turned out to be correct news, of a Bush presidency.
You see, in fact, that stocks fell a little bit during the 4 hours of the Kerry presidency. And then they rose a bit when it became the Bush presidency.
Now, the difference between a new Democratic president and a new Republican president in the space of 4 hours was actually pretty small. It's about 1.5%. Now, this is just a sliver of evidence, but it does suggest that the people who pay the most attention to the working economy, which is to say Wall Street investors, didn't really care all that much about which president they got. And most economists will tell you that the president's role when it comes to the economy is much closer to, let's say, a cheerleader than a CEO.
Well, yeah, but you're never going to see Obama or Romney out there going, "I can do nothing." Right?
No, you won't. They've got their self-interest. But just once, I'd love a presidential candidate to get up there on the stump and say, "My fellow Americans, I can't control the U.S. economy. I've got a little bit of influence, but mostly it does what it does. If it gets worse on my watch, you shouldn't blame me. And if it happens to get better, you probably shouldn't give me too much credit either."
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Stephen Dubner.
I think not. Now you know why I'm free to be on your radio show. Nobody in Washington wants to touch me.
That's exactly right. Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, we talked about this on the show a couple of weeks ago, the plan from former House Speaker Newt Gingrich to get gas prices down to $2.50 a gallon. How, we asked, might that happen? Well, the experts we talked to said, among other things, that Los Angeles and New York, everybody there, would have to stop driving completely. The Atlantic magazine today takes another tack. They said we could get there with about $187 billion a year in government subsidies. The math is pretty interesting. There's a link on our website if you want to check it out, marketplace.org. All right, that is Marketplace from APM on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow took back 0.6%, 78 points. The NASDAQ picked up 0.8%, 25 points. The S&P 500 added 0.2%, 9 points. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.